All right, let's jump right in to a story. Literally, we're going to jump into the middle of it. Exodus 17. Go back to there. Exodus 17. And we're going to start in verse 8. And it says, "And then Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. Moses came to Joshua," or said to Joshua, "Choose some men for us, go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, one on the other side, so his hands were steady until the sun set. And Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with his sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this as a reminder in a book and recite it in the hearing of Joshua. I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar, and he called it, "The Lord is my banner." So I kind of emphasized it back in verse 8, that the passage started out with the word "then." The word "then," along with "therefore," are transitional words. And it's telling us that there's something more we need to understand. Something happened prior, and we need to understand that so that we can fully understand what happened then. At the beginning of chapter 17, so prior, the Israelites had been hiking through the wilderness, hopefully en route towards the land that God had promised them. And they've just settled down to camp at Rephidim, but there's no water. The hike they had just completed would have made many of them pretty weary, especially the old, the feeble, maybe the young. They were ready for a rest. It also would have made them thirsty. Camp was supposed to be a place where they expected rejuvenation. A place and time to catch up their breath, get some rest, and replenish their energy. We kind of, like the Israelites, from time to time think, "I think I'm doing a good job being on God's path. I've made it over another hill, or even a mountain, but now that's behind me. And I wouldn't mind a little bit of time to rejuvenate. Catch my breath. Take a cool glass of water. Replenish some energy. I'd like to just coast for a couple of minutes." But then, sometimes our biggest challenges comes while we're at camp. Because back in verse 1, it was God who commanded them to camp. He chose where the camp was, knowing that there was no water there. How in the world could he neglect us like that? He knows we need that. We feel like we're doing what God would have us do, but there's times when we're still thirsty. Maybe we're thirsty in about our health, that diagnosis. Maybe we're thirsty in our finances. I just can't seem to get enough to pay all the bills. Maybe we're thirsty in our relationships, in our marriage. Even though we're on the path, we still have needs and we can't see the water. And then comes the anger, the blame. We allow our emotions to take us to a point where what Sarah and the kids were just talking about, we'll probably enter into sin. Because verse 2 and 3 of chapter 17 in Exodus, it sounds like some of the Israelites had stooped down, picked up a golf ball size stone, maybe a baseball size stone. We'll leave that on. And stand there in front of Moses. We need to have a chat. Something needs to be done, or else. They are that close to sinning. It's during those times that they, but we, allow ourselves to forget that everything God does and everything that He allows will turn to good, period. He hasn't forgotten us. What's been forgotten is that we're in a battle. We're still in a battle. It was there yesterday, it's here today, and it's still going to be here tomorrow. It's a battle not of flesh and blood, but of spirit. And what we really lose sight of is God's presence. We think because we can't see Him or feel Him in the moment, that He's no longer protecting us. He's not trying to sustain us any longer. Can't remember the last time I was blessed, because it wasn't a minute ago. Probably not going to forgive me. Why would He care with anything as far as mercy and love? However, before the then was chapter 14. All the Israelites were stuck literally between a rock and a hard place. And God parted the water. In chapter 15, again, they were thirsty. There was water, but it wasn't drinkable. God sweetened it. Chapter 16, they were hungry, and God sent manna. Not just once, not just for a day, but for 6 days. Every 6 days, except for on the Sabbath, there was manna. There was plenty to eat. And sometimes we sit back, still munching on the manna, and think God's forgotten us because we still can't see the water. This path that we're on is not simply filled with ups and downs. It's treacherous because it's filled with and then. The only way we're going to make to our destination is with God's help. Here a week ago, I finished reading through the Bible once again. And then restarted. I'm continuously on reading through the Bible cover to cover. And so right now I'm in these passages. But I know coming up shortly is Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, and then Chronicles. And inevitably, when I read through those passages and some of these passages, I go, how in the world could they do that? Right? They had God right there in the camp with them. They watched the waters part. How could they start complaining so quickly? Because what he'd just done for them was only a chapter ago. Okay, maybe it was a few days ago and for them, a few weeks, maybe a couple years ago. But for us, we look at it and go, this is just a chapter ago. Come on, get over it. Until we feel like, oh, it's happening to me now. Our journey starts to feel like their journey. There's multiple times Moses phrases, now what am I supposed to do? In 17:4 is one of them. It says, so Moses cried out to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. How did God respond? He said, take up your staff, do what I say, and see what I do. In verse 7, Moses calls the place Massa in Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? We know God is real, but from time to time, do we allow ourselves to wonder, is he still with me or not? How many of us have experienced God coming through right at the last moment, right at the breaking point? All of us have, right? What if he hadn't done it that way? Why would he do it that way? Well, first of all, he's a sovereign God, which means he wants us to have faith in him, which means he wants us to grow our faith in him. And how can our faith grow if we never have to endure? If our faith is never stretched, it will never grow further. This is not me at all. But what if I decided to become diligent and every day, 5 days a week, I jogged 1 mile? And after 1 year of that diligence, I have a little bit of confidence. I feel like I have a little bit more strength than I did a year ago. And that mile seems kind of easy now. So I sign up for a marathon. 26 miles. What happens to me in the second mile? Maybe not a whole lot, but it's like, okay, wasn't like the first mile, was it? About the third mile, I'm huffing and puffing. Do I even make it to the fourth or fifth mile? Maybe not, because my endurance was for a mile. If I wanted to train for that marathon, yeah, I probably would have started with a mile, maybe a couple. But over the next coming weeks, I need to increase that, don't I? Then I need to increase it again, and then again. And I don't stop at 26 miles because I don't want to stop 3 feet from the finish line. No, probably a couple of times I've ran 30 miles just to know that I can do it. We need to be growing our faith. God knows that better than us by far. Because he knows what we're already capable of, but he also knows what we're going to need to be capable of further down the path. The enemy, on the other hand, wants us to focus on the problem or the problems and forget what God has done. Forget what he's doing, what he has planned. He wants us to turn around and go back to being slaves for him. So back to our story in Exodus, God's just given them water. And even Moses now is ready to sit down and finally rest for a few moments. And just as they're enjoying some of the finest H2O you could ever find, right? Comes verse 8. And then Amalek came and fought with the Israel in were with Israel in Rephidim. Can't we get a break? The year-end bonus that I really needed didn't come through. Now both cars are in the shop. 13-year-old needs $5,000 worth of braces. An aunt, co-worker, and a friend are all dying from cancer. Buried 3 family members last year. And now mama's gone. Is God still here? For the Israelites, for Moses, for us, sometimes, and on a regular basis, it feels like it's just one thing after another. It's not just one thing after another. It's the same things over and over. All while in the same camp. Many times it's things that we can't even make sense of. Why? How could this even start? How did this happen? Israel has to fight Amalek. Amalek is Esau's grandson. Jacob is Esau's brother. Jacob's name was changed to? What? We have to fight family? How often do we experience the people who should be pushing us forward? They're the ones that are holding us back. We can't forget what took place for us in the last chapter. God knows what is coming, and he'll provide the water before the battle. God doesn't just simply supply our physical needs. He also takes care of our spiritual needs. He understood, he warned us, this is not about flesh and blood. He's provided us with armor. He's provided us with spiritual gifts and talents. All of which are absolutely worthless if we fail to make full use of them. We are to stand strong against the enemy. Joshua had to go down to the battlefield. Moses had to go up the hill with his staff. Joshua had to keep fighting despite how the enemy reacted to it. Moses had to keep his arms raised. And as his arms got tired, others were there to help him by bringing a stone over, giving him a place to sit. Then they helped hold up his hands. And then God provided the victory. What would have happened if Joshua, Moses, Aaron, or Hur would have decided to go crawl into a cave and wallow in self-pity? Thankfully, they each had the faith in God's ability and his love to get them through this and back on the road to the promised land. Joshua didn't go down to the battlefield by himself. He had others around him to help. Moses didn't go up by himself. He had others to help him. We got to get better at sharing our battles with one another so that we can help each other through. As long as we're doing the things that we've been called to do, then the battle is still being won. If any one of us allows themselves to be removed from the battle, that means only one thing. The greater battle still will be won. However, now there's one that's a slave to the enemy. Over the last few years, my faith has grown dramatically. It's not perfect by any stretch, but it is drastically different than what it was 10 years ago. I no longer ask, is God with me? I know He's there. However, I still have those times of, I don't like this. Or those times of, and then? One thing after another, from angles I would never have anticipated. I didn't like this last week. But God was with me. Last Thursday, another close friend of mine was diagnosed with cancer. That was the end then. Before, 4 years ago, a friend, part of this congregation, youth, watched him grow from a very young teen up to adult, was diagnosed with bone cancer. Told he might live 2 to 3 years. Died about 18 months later. 3 years ago, a friend of mine threw the feast. Diagnosed with cancer, died about a year later. Earlier this year, reached out to a friend that I neglected to keep up with that I knew through church. Last October, they're diagnosed with prostate cancer. Told maybe 5 years to live. And then, this past Wednesday morning, I had to drop off to the friend who was just diagnosed with cancer and her husband, something at their home. Husband comes to the door and tells me they just found out it's stage 3. After I left the house, we couldn't talk. They were literally on the phone with the doctor when I rang the doorbell. So he literally just told me that information and said, but I got to go back to the phone call. We'll talk later. I had about a little over an hour to kill before my next errand or appointment. So I started talking to God. It's just, I don't like us. But I'm supposed to be doing something. What is it I'm supposed to be doing? What can I say? These two friends are not part of the church. Probably the best way to describe them is mostly agnostic. What am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to be prepared for next? The next big thing that was on my list that day, around lunchtime, I was supposed to go flying. And got with my instructor and told him, and I told him that I wanted to chat first anyhow, and told him, I said, you know, the last time I went up, I'd went up by myself. In fact, I was supposed to have, that day, this is over a week ago, I was supposed to have lunch with Jerry and Cindy Hubbard. I was supposed to fly up to Flint. And one of the things we do is we really look at the weather, what's happening. And it was somewhat of a nice day, The winds were a little bit stronger than normal, but you know, nothing there to alert me that I shouldn't make the flight or anything like that. Got all prepared, got in the plane, started off down the runway, and you shove the accelerator basically to full on, and you start going down the runway. Well, within just a few feet, the plane's trying to veer to the left. Well, I correct for that, and just a few feet later, the nose is popping up. And this is supposed to be a little bit further down the road, down the runway, before the nose is popping up. But I'm facing into the wind, and the wind's a little bit stronger than normal. Okay. And I correct for that. Now I'm in the air, but I need to get my speed up. And so we stay in what we call ground effect, and that's literally where I hold the plane 2 to 3 feet off the runway, and I just fly along the runway. And there's a cushion of air that's there because of me being so close to the runway that actually helps lift the plane, but allows me to pick up quite a bit of speed pretty quickly. So I get the speed I need, and I start climbing. And bounce around and left and right, and you know, I'm getting thrown around a little bit. And I get to not really the top of my climb, but to the point where I'm going to turn out away from the runway heading. I'm flying up, now I'm going to make a left or I'm going to make a right. I start to make that turn. The wind's mostly coming at me, but as I make that turn, I really feel the wind grab hold of that plane and start pushing me. I don't feel like I'm going to go down, but it's all I can do to hang on to this plane. And after just a few seconds, I decide, you know what, I'm not making the trip. I don't think this is safe. So I decide I'm just going to land right back, you know, go back around and land on the same runway I just took off. And I realize, this isn't going to be fun. Because I just took off from that one runway and I felt what the winds were trying to do to my plane. So I start praying. I just said, Father, I'm not going to make the trip, but would you please tame down the winds just for those few minutes while I land the plane? And as I'm coming in, I'm still bouncing around a little bit. You know, I have to keep recorrecting to make sure I'm aimed up for this runway. And the biggest thing I don't want is, as I'm getting really close to the runway, I'm down really low, and I'm slowing down on purpose. The last thing I want is for what they call wind shear to take place, where I just drop out of the sky, because there's no wind underneath me. You know, because right now there's quite a bit of wind coming, but if that wind just stops, I'm in a little bit of trouble, maybe a lot of trouble. And God protected me. The winds were calmer. They weren't the calmest they've ever been, but they were common. I got to land, actually had a pretty decent landing. But I was glad to be out of the airplane. So when I met with my instructor Wednesday, I told him, I said, I was rattled. I don't think I should have took off that day. And it's not that I didn't have skills to a level where I could fly the plane in those conditions. It's like, shouldn't there have been something that told me, don't go up, don't go up, don't go up? And he reassured me. He says, you took off in conditions that you and I haven't experienced. I've only been flying by myself for about 2 months now. Prior to that, it was always with him. He says, over the summer, you and I had, for whatever reason, every time we flew, we flew in some pretty calm weather. He says, you and I never got to really spend a lot of time in more windy conditions. I said, no, you're right. And he said, that day that you took off, he said, I looked at the weather, and I didn't mind you going, but he says, I knew it would be a little bit of a rough ride because of the winds. And he says, so I texted him as soon as I was back on the ground. I texted him and said, I'm back on the ground, safe, plane's fine, but I'm not doing the rest of the trip. And he texted right back, good decision. And he said, you made a good decision that day, because he says, after you left, I looked at the weather, you know, most current, you know, within the moment. He says, the winds were supposed to pick up a little bit more while you're gone. He says, so you made a good decision. But he said, the reality is, it was just some circumstances that you're not used to. He says, you flew the plane back around and down. He says, you might be in those circumstances again, but next time you'll be a little bit more prepared for them. Give me a little bit of a confidence boost. And then he said, the wind today is kind of similar. Would you like to go up with me? Just do some, you know, some landings and takeoffs. I said, yeah, let's do that. We did 7 that day. And he shared with me 2 or 3 tips and tricks, you know, that, so here's some things you need to concentrate a little bit more on when you're coming in for a landing in those in these conditions on your takeoff. If you do this a little bit more, add this, you know, take away this. And when we got out of the plane Wednesday afternoon, it was like, okay, I'm on my way to becoming a pilot, a safe pilot. I'm better today than what I was last week. I'm still thinking about Rick and Jerry. And now the rest of my afternoon's free. And I really want to go over, and I knew Rick was probably going to go to the office and get some work done. He and his wife own a business, and they run it together with one part-time employee. I was pretty certain he was going to be at the office, and I knew he was going to be distraught, and I wanted to just go and see how I could help. But again, now I have a half-hour drive towards East Lansing, and I'm talking with God, what can I say or do for Rick and or Jerry? And as I come up to East Lansing, this is a fault, and this is pointed out to me by another friend of mine. I don't like the Michigan U-turns. So the intersection you're coming up to, and you want to make a left. No, you can't do it here. You got to go down further, and then you make a U-turn, then you come back to the intersection. I was like, well, at Costco, I can go in their back lot and drive through and do away with all that, but I'm cutting through their parking lot in a sense. So I'm doing that. And I passed the front entrance, and they have a tire center. And out in front of the tire center, they've got an island with air pumps where people can fill up their tires with air. There's 2 cars in those spaces, and I see what appears to be a young lady, I can't tell the age at the moment, down at the front passenger tire, which is furthest away from me. And there is a male over top of her, and all I see is, my windows are up, I can't hear anything, but I know he's screaming at the top of his lungs. I'm like, what in the world? And as I get up right about parallel with them, I see another aggressive action, and the hose that was in her hand goes flying way up in the air. He has grabbed it and flung it hard. And I pull up right behind her vehicle, slam it in park, and I jump out, didn't turn off the engine, didn't shut the door. And I wasn't running, but I was going after him. And I just yelled out, hey, you got a problem? Now you got a problem with me. And he turned and looked at me. I said, don't you ever yell or act like that towards a female again. And he's a little bit startled, but he literally just turns and starts walking directly away from us. And I get past her, and I was going to go grab him. I don't know what I was going to do, but it was not going to be mild. But he kept walking, and I realized, I want to check on her. So I turned back around, and as I did, the tears just start flowing. She's probably about 30. I said, did he hurt you? And she said, no. I said, did he hit you? And she says, no, he tried to take my phone, but I wouldn't let him. And then he yanked the air hose out of my hand. I said, I saw that happen. I said, but you're okay. And she said, yes. I said, who is he? She said, I don't even know where he came from. He just came up and started screaming at me that I had cut off him and a couple other cars. So it's road rage. And I looked up, and he's very close to the front of the store now. She's okay. I kind of want to go after him, but I kind of don't want to leave her, because it dawns on me, I don't want him to see me leave her, and then he decides he can come back. So, and I'm literally in the middle of an aisle, so I get back in my truck. She thanks me 6 or 7 times. I get back in my truck, and I decide to drive up where I saw him departing towards. If I see him at the door, getting into a car, in a car, I'm stopping. We're having a chat. I didn't find him. And again, I didn't really want to leave her out of my eyesight, so I went back and I parked a handful of spaces down from where she was still at and just watched to see if he was going to come back. He didn't. I watched her drive away. Biggest odd thing on my mind when I drove into that parking lot was, how do I help Rick and Jerry? And God reminded me, we're still in a battle. And it's not about blood, flesh and blood. Aaron, you don't like what you're going through at the moment, but are you still willing to fight the enemy? And he gave me opportunity to stand up to the enemy. I didn't have to fight. Why did God put me in that parking lot at that time? I know he did. It wasn't me. It wasn't because I was skirting the road rules. He wanted me there for a reason. There's still a battle going on. Am I going to sulk in whatever it is I'm sulking in or want to sulk in for the moment? Or am I going to go about what he would have me do? Not simply for myself, but for many, many others. As I left that parking lot, it started dawning on me. That twice, I was blessed with these huge, incredible opportunities to go and visit Eric down in Texas. He was the first friend that died. He was diagnosed with a bone cancer that took him very quickly. It took his arm first. But I was blessed with 2 opportunities, one early on. He lived in Texas, even though he was from this area. His parents still live here. He lived in Texas. And I got to go down and visit Texas for other reasons. But the first time was not too long after he'd been diagnosed. And we went out to lunch. And we knew each other very well enough that I got to ask him some pretty intimate questions. What's going through your mind? Because doctors have told you. He literally just lost his arm at that point. He lost his arm. He got diagnosed in, I think, October. It was right after the feast. And in January or February, they took his arm at the shoulder. I mean, didn't leave any shoulder. They took it inside of the shoulder. And I asked Eric, what's going through your mind right now? He shared with me. And less than a year later, I had to go back down. And this was only, I think, no more than 2 months before he died. And I got to go out to lunch with him again. I said, Eric, what's on your mind? And he was at peace with death. But I had to think about the fact that I was blessed with opportunities to go to Texas. Those opportunities hovered around the opportunity to help set up a feast site for multiple years with another close friend. Then I had to be reminded that the only way I got to make that trip was because I'd been blessed with a really good income, a really nice career, but with an employer who, when I go to him and say, hey, this is kind of a strange request, could I have some time for this? And every time, the Haar family says, yeah, we'll work around that. God's blessed me with the career, with the wife, with the family, with the income. I've only worked 3 days a week, technically, for now over 10 years. I still get a full salary. I still get all the benefits. And even still, even though I'm only supposed to be there for 3 days a week, at times I still ask them for things like what I'm talking about, and they go, oh, yeah, no problem. We'll work around that. I was reminded that Tom, who I'd met through the feast, lived in the Saginaw area. I'd met him at the feast many years prior. And we had a connection. We enjoyed each other's company. But because of our different lifestyles, he was older than me by a good 15 years. We just didn't keep up with each other. Until COVID hit, I sent out an email saying that this congregation is not shutting down. This Sabbath service will be here every week. Because all the other churches that I was familiar with shut down. Stop having services for varying different reasons, but it's all because of the COVID issues. Tom calls me up one day after I sent out that email. He just says, Aaron, I'm going to see you Saturday. He says, I got your email. He says, I can't tell you how uplifting that was because I hate to miss church. So him and his wife started coming to church every week with us down here, making a little over, well, same drive as Jake and Sarah. Actually, it's Jake's uncle that I'm talking about, Tom Bain. So I got to reconnect with an old friend. And within 2 months of them coming here on a regular basis, one Sabbath after services, Tom makes the comment about his house being flooded. What? What are you talking about? Well, yeah, we're not living at the house. It was flooded a couple weeks ago. Remember when the dams broke north of Midland and Saginaw 2 years ago? Almost 3 years ago? Well, the river comes down through Flint. When those dams broke, Saginaw area has a lot of lowland. Tom and Barb's house is within a mile of the river. They ended up with close to a foot of water on the first floor. He'd been there ever. He didn't miss a service. 2 weeks after the flood, in passing, he makes the comment, oh yeah, what do you mean you're not living at the house? Well, we're living in an RV in my daughter's place down the road. Well, what are you doing about the house? Oh, I think my son-in-laws are going to go in and see if they can cut the drywall about the 4 foot level, and it's kind of drying out now. But I've flipped houses. I've seen water damage. I'm like, Tom, you got a major remodel there that needs to take place. Oh, we'll get around to it. God's blessed me with previous opportunities where I've flipped homes. I know what to do with a hammer and a screwdriver. I know how to put a home together. Tom, I'm coming up tomorrow. meaning Sunday. And I'll be there Monday, and I'll be there Wednesday, and I'll be there every Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday that I need to until your house is put back in order. And I started going. And shortly after I started going, there's this funny lump that showed up on his neck. Didn't know what it was at first. Yeah, I'll go see a doctor at some point, but we need to get this house done. The feast comes around. He won't go to the doctor because he's afraid now, because the thing is this big. It's close to a baseball size on his neck. He's not going to miss the feast, so he'll wait and talk to the doctor at the feast, so the doctor cannot tell him not to go to the feast. He goes to the feast, then he goes to see the doctor. It's cancerous. It's already in his bone. A few months later, they have to remove his arm. And over that summer, Tom's living room, I've known for quite a few years, it's a small living room, but it has a baby grand piano in it. He loves music, loved playing music. So several times, we got to sit down and play music together. Now his left arm is gone. That was hard to watch. And we got to know each other well enough that I got to ask him, what's going through your mind? And he shared, Tom was very close with God. Tom did not like what was going on. His granddaughters were just coming out of high school or entering college, knew that they'd be getting married in the next couple of years. Was looking forward to that, looking forward to great-grandchildren. Pretty much knew now that that's not going to happen for him. So how do I take care of my wife? Got to get this house done. House got done just a couple weeks before he passed. I was reminded of meeting Rick and Jerry probably 30 years ago. In that first year, few years of my career. And then more recently, I had a friend through church called me up one Sunday morning and said, hey, would you mind talking to my sister? I knew him and his sister when they were little, real little. I knew his sister got married and moved out west, and that she was a goldsmith, but that was about all I knew. But they just lost their dad suddenly last year. And he said, could you talk to Sarah? She's out from out west because of her dad's funeral. He says, because she's in a really bad, bad job situation as a goldsmith, and I think you should talk to her. I said, well, I'd be willing to talk to her. You know, I'm thinking, you know, when she gets back home, she gets settled down, you know, from what's going on, burying her dad. He says, well, would you want to talk to her right now? I said, if she's up to it, absolutely. She gets on the phone, and she vaguely remembers me. She tells me that she's been working for the same jewelry store for 15 years as a goldsmith. And that she could, that day, if she wanted to, she could walk down the street a block and a half where the jewelry store is at and get a job at Qdoba that paid more than what she was making. I said, you gotta be kidding me. You got 15 years of experience on the bench and someone's paying you less than what Qdoba would pay you? She says, yeah. I said, what about the towns, other towns? She lived out in, is Wyoming due north of Denver? I think it is. I don't remember the town she was in, but she was just into Wyoming, north of Denver. And she says, there really isn't any good jewelry stores, because they're all small towns, I would have to move, you know, it'd be a couple hours away. I said, okay. I said, would you like to keep working as a goldsmith? She says, I love this work. I said, okay, what's your husband do? Oh, he's got a really good job. He works from home. We can live anywhere we want. I said, are you kidding me? She says, no. I said, so where would you like to live? Because as a goldsmith today with experience, I can guarantee you, I can help you find you a job that pays really well anywhere. Because there's just not enough people coming into the field. And she says, well, we've never really talked about it, but she says, because of what just happened with Dad, I really wish I was closer to Mom. I said, okay. Do you want to live in Michigan? Don't need to live in Michigan, but I'd like to be within a day's drive of Mom. Okay. I'll see what I can do. Went to my boss the next day, told him the story, and he's on a group chat with other independent jewelry store owners. They're all over the U.S. And he says, I'll put it on there. I'm going to put your name and your phone number. Okay. Man, did the calls start coming in. We've been looking for somebody. They get 15 years experience? When could they start? There's a guy out in the Seattle area. He was willing to move her immediately, pay all the expenses, give her a huge sign-on bonus, give her a wonderful salary. He was in a fairly high-end area. I looked up his store. I looked up the area. That would have been a nice situation. It was the wrong place, though. It's too far from Mom. Then a guy from Sebring, Florida, got a hold of me. Really wanted to meet Sarah. And again, would take care of them, you know, get them there, pay them well. Sounded like it was a family store, a family ran. It would be a really good situation. Still too far away. Then a guy from Chicago got a hold of me. It was in the right area, but I didn't get that vibe of, I think this might actually be a good situation for her. Just didn't get that vibe. I told Sarah about all of these. And then one night, I had to drop off at Rick and Jerry's house. So I do some side work for them, and so I see him on a very regular basis. I dropped off, and I told him the story. He says, Aaron, why didn't you call me yesterday? She needs to go up to Davison, Michigan. It's an hour and a half from here. It's in her mom's backyard. They've been looking for an employee, for a goldsmith, for 2 years. These people are wonderful. They're religious, too. Aaron, you know, because he knows me. And I'd already shared with him that I knew her through church. Aaron, we got to talk to him. We got to call him right now. Calls them right then while I'm standing there and says, hey, there's this girl who's out in Wyoming. She went, blah, 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 blah. They said, yeah, we would love to meet her. This is Monday. She's flying home Tuesday night. Tuesday morning, she meets with them for what we call a bench test. They'll just give her a few jobs, see how she handles them, get to know her a little bit. Excuse me, no, this that was Sunday night when I met Rick and Jerry. We initially talked. Monday, they set up the bench test. It was done and over. There were smiles all around, but here's their comment to Sarah. We don't make any decisions like this until we've talked to God. Let's talk to God tonight, and we will give you an answer tomorrow before you go home. The next day they said, God did not tell us not to hire you. Would you like a job? She's been working there a year in her mom's backyard. Loves it. Ecstatic. And this comes through Rick and Jerry. God and his blessings has been there even before I was doing anything to deserve his consideration. He hasn't just blessed me with opportunities. but he's also with everything I needed when I needed it to get through the opportunity. If we feel like God is abandoning us or neglecting us, it's only because we're not out fighting the enemy or holding our hands up to him, our Father. We have to keep in mind, remember the times that he helped, he comforted, he blessed, he healed, he fed, he warmed us, because it was just in the last chapter. A day is approaching when all the battles will be over and we will be in camp with God, doing all of his will, but without all the distractions of the enemy. Exodus 17, verse 13. And Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a reminder in a book and recite it to in the hearing of Joshua. I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, a hand upon the banner of the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Remember, if we allow ourselves to be taken as slaves of the enemy, a day is coming when the enemy will be utterly destroyed and even forgotten. We may not like what is happening to us right now, but God is still here with us.